Thank you, Matt, for those kind words, and good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for having me over here in Western Australia. As Matt foreshadowed, when I was first invited to come and talk to this gathering, it was while the Varanus Island gas crisis was in full flight and before the other crisis that has come to dominate the headlines had reached the depths which it has. About 12 years ago, I was briefly on the board of the Gas and Fuel Corporation, as the Victorian state-owned gas distributor was at that stage described, and I thought that's what GFC stood for. As some of you may have read now, GFC is what the Prime Minister routinely refers to as the global financial crisis, and they have GFC meetings and GFC briefings and all of that sort of thing apparently on a daily basis, daily meaning probably starting at 4:30 in the morning, given what I understand of the current Prime Minister's work habits. I think I heard someone earlier refer to the gas crisis that you've had as a liquids crisis, and in some ways the credit crunch began as a liquidity crisis. So without trying to stretch the analogies too much further than that, there's obviously some common themes in the remarks that I want to talk about today. So if you'll forgive me for departing from the advertised topic to some extent, I'll say a few words about the economic impact of the gas crisis that you had here beginning in August, and then spend most of my time talking about the global credit crunch and its impact on the broader economy. As I understand it, from the other side of the country, the explosion that occurred at the beginning of June at Varanus Island on the northwest coast of Western Australia took out about 30% of Western Australia's total gas supply, and the impact of it was concentrated on heavy industry, particularly mining and manufacturing, though that was to some extent mitigated by the ability to bring in or rearrange gas from other parts or of the state, not from other parts of the country, of course, since there's no connection, and from some gradual improvement over time in the availability of gas from the Varanus Island plant. But there was almost no negative impact on the residential sector as a result of decisions that were made by government. I'll say in a minute a little bit about the contrast between the way in which the Western Australian government approached this crisis and the way in which the Victorian government dealt with an event that was in some way similar a decade or so ago. But as I say, the Western Australian government's response seemed to be focused for the most part on trying to arrange gas and alternative energy sources to make up for what was lost from the explosion at Varanus Island. In particular, increases in production from elsewhere on the Northwest Shelf, repairs and maintenance of coal power, bringing back coal-fired power generation that had been previously mothballed, and to some extent importation of diesel generating capacity, particularly in more remote areas, as a substitute for gas from Varanus Island. According to the Western Australian Treasury, and you may have heard these estimates released, discussed earlier this morning, the total cost of the gas supply shutdown is of the order of $2 billion, spread over the June and September quarters, although there may be some lingering, though harder to detect, impact in the December quarter, and that as a result of that, overall economic growth in Western Australia will be about half a percentage point lower, employment growth a quarter of a percentage point lower, and according to the Treasury, export growth around 1.25 percentage point lower than would otherwise have been the case. It will actually be quite difficult to identify precisely those impacts in the data when the September quarter figures are released in early December, simply because there are so many other things going on at the time that will make it difficult to attribute the weakening in all of those aggregates that will occur solely to the gas crisis because of the overlying impact of the financial crisis and the gathering storms for the global economy. Nationally, if those figures estimated by the Western Australia and Treasury are correct, then over the entire three quarters, June quarter, September quarter and December quarter, national GDP growth would probably be about a quarter of a percentage point lower than otherwise. As I mentioned before, there are perhaps some parallels between the Varanus Island gas explosion that occurred in Western Australia this year and the Longford explosion that occurred at Esso's facility in Gippsland in eastern Victoria in 1998. The human costs, unfortunately, of the Longford gas explosion were greater than had been experienced in Western Australia. Two people were killed as a result of the explosion, and there were a number of other workplace injuries. Longford supplied nearly all of Victoria's gas. A very small proportion at that stage came from the Otway Basin in Victoria's southwest, but the explosion at Longford took out 98% of Victoria's gas supply, and there wasn't sufficient capacity, really, to bring a great deal down from New South Wales or via South Australia, from the Moomba gas fields or from Queensland. And so, as a result, with gas representing the primary source of energy for 80% of households and 50% of commercial enterprises, there were potentially major disruptions to the Victorian economy. The Victorian government at the time, led by Geoff Kennett, took the decision to concentrate as much of the short-term pain as could be done on households. Households were told to turn off their gas supply at the meter, and very substantial fines were prescribed and, in a couple of high-profile cases, imposed on people who failed to comply with that obligation. I can recall distinctly myself having cold showers for 2.5 weeks, as I recall correctly, before we were allowed to turn the gas back on. And even then, during that phase, there were some restrictions, although it was hard to judge how strictly they were enforced, on how much gas you could use, how long you could shower for a day. And as a result, 4 million consumers, as you can see, there were left without gas for a period of, in total, 19 days. And small businesses likewise, that is those operating restaurants, for example, and linen facilities and so forth, were affected by the downturn in the availability of gas. Maybe the Victorian government took that decision partly because Geoff Kennett had already established a reputation for not being overly fussed about what individual voters thought of his economic policies, although he secured a victory in 1996, notwithstanding having administered some pretty tough medicine to Victorian voters in much the same way as the New South Wales government is now having to dish out to the citizens of that state in order to clean up the mess which that government's predecessors had left. In the end, of course, Geoff Kennett lost the subsequent election in 1999, although my recollection of the time is that memories of households having to take cold showers for the best part of 3 weeks was not a key factor in Kennett losing office. There were other things that contributed to that. It was perhaps also relevant that at the time of the gas explosion, the election was thought to be more than a year away, whereas the Western Australian government, whatever they might have said publicly, could not have been oblivious to the fact that an election was likely to have been held within 6 months of the Varanus Island explosion. In the end, as of course you know, it was held within a couple of months of it, and as it happened, the government lost. But I'm sure, even if nothing was said publicly, that those kind of political considerations entered into the decision not to impose any significant part of the adjustment costs to the curtailment of gas supply on households. Another difference in the Victorian circumstances is that the Victorian government decided to establish a royal commission to investigate both the causes of the explosion, and given that two people were killed in it, I guess that added a degree of urgency about establishing the causes of the explosion and who or where the responsibility for that and the subsequent handling of it lay. And Darryl Dawson, QC, who was the Royal Commissioner, also made some investigations and reports into mitigating action. You can see there that the Royal Commission estimated the cost to the Victorian economy at about 0.8% of gross state product that year. That is a little higher than the estimates which the Western Australian Treasury have made for the cost of the Varanus Island explosion to the Western Australian economy. As I say, the disruption here has been less visible to the average person than it was in Victoria because of the choices that government have made. That said, when the dust is finally settled out of this, it may well be that the cost of Varanus Island is at least as costly because of the number of businesses that have been affected and when you take account of the mitigating impact of the use of alternative energy sources. Ultimately, Western Australians will, as perhaps you've discussed earlier today, need to consider issues of alternative energy, alternative supplies or sources of different types of energy, the desirability or otherwise, and the costs associated with connecting Western Australia up to the national grid, so that, gas grid that is, so that in the event of another event like this on either side of the country, it might be possible for gas resources to be moved from areas that aren't affected to areas that have been affected by the interruption of gas supply. And that probably goes for electricity as well, although, of course, that's easier to move around over longer distances than gas. But there are probably further lessons to be learned from the Victorian experience for Western Australia, and it may well be that some kind of formal inquiry ultimately takes place that sheds more light on that. Let me, however, as I foreshadowed, move on now to talk about the other major crisis which is likely to be with us in terms of its effects for a long time after the full gas supply to Western Australia is restored. And I'm referring there, of course, to the global financial crisis. And in my view, the best way of understanding both the crisis itself and the way it is playing out on the actual economy is to recognise it, or is to see it, as the bursting of possibly the biggest financial market bubble that the world has seen in at least 100 years. Maybe longer than that, although it's hard to know how big relative to the size of the economy of the early 1820s the South Sea Bubble and the like actually were. But this one, relative to the global economy, was certainly a very big one. And ironically, the seeds of it were sown in the response of governments and central banks to the bursting of the previous big financial market bubble, that is the tech bubble on stock markets in the late 1990s, which peaked, as you might recall, in March 2000, and which subsequently saw share prices in most markets around the world, other than Australia's, which didn't have much of a tech sector to have a bubble in the first place, decline by orders of magnitude similar to what we've seen share markets decline over the last 12 or 13 months, that is of the order of about 40%. And at that time, the world's leading central banks were very concerned that the combination of sharply falling share prices and recession, in circumstances where inflation had been unusually low, partly because of the emergence over the previous decade of China and India as low-cost producers of goods and services, and partly because of the disinflationary impact of the technology that lay behind the tech bubble, that a recession in those circumstances could see the world's major economies experiencing the same combination of outright deflation, that is falling consumer prices, and recession, that Japan had experienced for a decade after the collapse of its property and share market bubbles at the beginning of the 1990s. And so to forestall that possibility, the US Federal Reserve and the other leading central banks cut interest rates to the lowest levels that had been seen in generations, to 1% in the case of the US, to 2% in Europe, to zero in Japan, which, notwithstanding some people's hopes, is actually as low as interest rates can go. And that was the right thing to have done at the time, because although most other economies apart from Australia did experience recessions after the tech wreck, those recessions were by historical standards mild and brief, and growth resumed in the years that followed. The mistake that Alan Greenspan and his counterparts in other major central banks made was in keeping interest rates too low for too long after the recessions were over and growth had begun to resume, after share markets had bottomed and begun to climb again, and after inflationary pressures had begun to re-emerge. The cash rate in the US was still at 1% as late as August 2004, and Europe and Japan were even later to begin returning interest rates to normal. On top of that, the central banks of major developing countries like China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, who were all running large current account surpluses which were putting upward pressure on their exchange rates, sought to resist revaluations of their currencies by in effect printing massive amounts of their own money and selling it in exchange for US dollars to stop their currencies going up, and thus flooding the long end of financial markets with cash pushing long-term rates down at the same time as central banks in the developed world were holding short-term interest rates down. So what you had was an environment of artificially and unnecessarily low interest rates. And in that environment, people became increasingly willing to take on more risk, both by gearing up, that is, borrowing more, and by investing in increasingly risky investment products in order to get rates of return that you could no longer get from conventional investments in a low interest rate environment. And at the same time, the supply side of financial markets, if I can refer thus to the Wall Street investment banks and the like, were increasingly willing to cater to the growing demand for increasingly risky investment products by creating them and selling them to a growing range of would-be investors. And Exhibit A in that regard was, of course, the subprime mortgage market in the United States, which had it at its origin the worthy idea of extending the privileges and benefits of home ownership to people who, because of their low income, intermittent employment history, or poor credit records, were historically precluded from access to mortgage finance. And subprime mortgages essentially did that by offering mortgages to people on terms that made it even easier for them to qualify. For example, with significant discounts to the going rate, which was already low in those circumstances, for an introductory or honeymoon period that would typically last at least 2 years, not requiring any payment of principal during that term, and in many cases not even requiring the payment of the full amount of interest, but rather through what was quaintly known as negative amortization, having some of that interest be added to the outstanding principal to be serviced once the honeymoon period was expired. And because these people often had no deposit, the loans were made on very high ratios to valuation of the underlying property in the expectation that the equity would be built up through rising house prices, rather than through saving in advance of getting a loan. And for a while, this worked fabulously well. It triggered a building boom. Lots more people got mortgages. The home ownership rate rose by some 2 percentage points, something which certainly hasn't happened in this country. And it was particularly pronounced among the Hispanic and African American communities in which home ownership had historically been well below the average. And that trend continued for a while, even after the Federal Reserve belatedly began raising interest rates from August 2004 onwards, and during a period in which they actually rose quite quickly to 5.25% just 2 years later by August 2006. But as a growing proportion of the mortgages that had been written during this period reached the end of their honeymoons, so that the people who'd taken them out found them resetting at substantially higher interest rates than they had led to expect, and servicing not only the principal, but also whatever interest obligation had been negatively amortized during the honeymoon period. Many people found themselves unable to maintain their newly higher mortgage repayment burdens. And because many of them had taken out loans at very high ratios to valuation, they found themselves owing more than the properties were worth. And in those circumstances, in the United States, where most mortgage financing is non-recourse, that is to say, in the event of a default, the creditor's rights are restricted solely to taking possession of the property and selling it, and don't extend, as they do in Australia, to going after any other assets or income that you might have to make up the difference, it is actually a rational decision in many cases to walk away. Yes, you have a big black mark on your credit record and won't get a mortgage again. But then most of the people who are in this position were in it because they didn't have a credit rating to begin with. And so they go back, if you like, to the trailer parks where they first came from, knowing that for 3 years or so they've lived in a house that they could never have otherwise contemplated being able to live in. And so the whole thing has unraveled. The building boom has come to an end and housing starts are at their lowest since the late 1980s. Mortgage borrowing has collapsed. The home ownership rate has declined to where it was before the subprime mortgage market boom began. And because there are now so many houses on the market for sale in the United States for whatever they can be sold for, as well as a physical excess of housing because of the previous building boom. American house prices have on average dropped by some 22% from their peak 2 years ago, which is the biggest decline in house prices since the 1930s. And the only good thing that can be said about this state of affairs is that America has made a lot of progress towards solving its housing affordability problem. If you can get a mortgage, housing is a lot more affordable in the United States than it was 2 years ago. Unfortunately, however, the implications of all this don't stop at a large number of people being tossed out of their homes and having to go back to the rental market, or of people having suffered capital loss, even if they're able to stay in their homes. Because so many of these subprime mortgages were bundled up by investment banks into quite complex securities, often known as collateralized debt obligations or CDOs, structured with the advice of rating agencies so that most of them would attract a AAA credit rating, which in turn conveyed to unsuspecting investors the belief that there was no risk of default or capital loss. As default rates on these mortgages rose to levels that did impose capital losses on investors in the AAA rated tranches of these products, their prices collapsed to less than 55% of their face value in the case of the AAA rated tranches and to as little as 4.5% in the case of the riskier tranches. And as the values of mortgage-backed securities collapsed, mark-to-market accounting rules and stock exchange disclosure requirements forced banks who were caught with inventories of mortgages and mortgage-backed securities when the music stopped to write them down to the value at which they could be sold in the marketplace, even if there was no intention of selling them. And that in turn has seen banks up to the end of last month record losses of some $675 billion, in addition to which other investors have lost around $180 billion. But whereas those other investors, hedge funds, mutual funds, pension funds and the like, pass those losses on to their clients, and that's capital loss, which they then have to deal with, when banks write off capital in orders of this magnitude, that has dramatic implications for the capacity of the financial system to lend. Because in nearly every country, the size of a bank's balance sheet is governed by what are called capital adequacy rules that in simple terms dictate that banks have to hold around 10 cents of capital for every dollar of loans on their books. And that means that if banks are forced to write off the best part of $700 billion of capital because of these losses, then depending on the extent to which they had fully used their gearing capacity, the amount of debt or credit which that capital can support is reduced by as much as $7 trillion. Now that's a mind-boggling sum, to scale it for you. The annual output of the world economy is equivalent these days to about $52 trillion. So you're talking about a substantial fraction of the world economy that can no longer be supported, in theory, by the capital of the banking system. And so banks have sought to go around the world raising new capital, and initially going cap in hand, as it were, to sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and China. They were able to do some of that. And they continued to do it after the semi-rescue of Bear Stearns in mid-April conveyed the impression to both banks and investors that the Federal Reserve and the US government would not allow big institutions that ran into difficulties to fail. Although the shareholders were extinguished in the Bear Stearns case, the debt providers were, in a sense, looked after by the Federal Reserve's $30 billion loan to JP Morgan. But when the US Treasury, partly in response to criticism from the right of politics about allowing so-called moral hazard to interfere with the operation of free markets, the Treasury decided to let Lehman Brothers go to the wall and then took Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and AIG, the big insurance company, into conservatorship, a form of bankruptcy, in terms that not only extinguished all the interests of shareholders but also of the senior debt holders. And when Washington Mutual was handed over to JP Morgan with essentially the same extinguishment not only of shareholders' entitlements but also of debt providers, the capital markets in effect went on strike as far as banks were concerned, and no bank was able to raise either capital or debt. With the result that by the weekend of 11 and 12th of October, the financial system was in extraordinary danger, to an extent that most people don't actually appreciate, of imploding in on itself. And it was only when the world's policymakers stood almost literally on the precipice of the abyss and, faced with a choice between the unpalatable and the unthinkable, chose the unpalatable. And the unpalatable has been a guarantee of banks' wholesale interbank borrowings, which in effect substitutes the credit ratings of governments for the rather lower credit ratings these days of most banks, a guarantee of retail borrowings, which in most countries, or deposits, which in most countries, including Australia, wasn't objectively necessary, but became inevitable once a few countries, beginning with Ireland, had begun to guarantee the deposits of their banks, triggering a flow of deposits from countries who at that stage hadn't guaranteed deposits in their banks and which would have mushroomed if all governments hadn't moved to guarantee their bank deposits. And then finally, the provision of sufficient capital by governments to banks, even at the expense of, as in Britain and the US and some European countries, governments becoming majority or whole owners of those banks, to allow them to write down the remaining toxic assets on their books to some kind of market value, which in many cases is zero, without destroying their capacity to lend or making those banks insolvent, which is where some $290 billion worth of capital has now been sufficient, as the tables indicate, to make up for the capital that has been destroyed by losses and write-downs associated with the subprime mortgage market meltdown. One of the most obvious consequences of the financial crisis as it's evolved over the last 15 months is the dramatic increase in the spread between official cash rates in each country, or more strictly, market expectations of where official cash rates are going to go, which are captured by the overnight index swap, or OIS market, on the one hand, and the rates which banks pay for the wholesale borrowings that they all, to some degree, depend on, because no modern bank these days has enough by way of customer deposits to fund all the loans that it makes to households and businesses. Normally, there's an extremely tight and close relationship between the cash rate and the cost of wholesale funds. And that is how monetary policy normally works, that the central bank raises or lowers the official cash rate. The rate which banks pay for wholesale funds then moves by the same order of magnitude, and that then leads the banks to raise or lower the rates which they charge their customers, the rates which actually influence borrowing and spending in the economy, by the same predictable amount very quickly. But as banks moved in the wake of this crisis to hoard the cash which they held and were reluctant to lend it to other banks for fear that they wouldn't get it back, and as other providers of wholesale funding to the financial systems, such as money market funds, felt the same way, the spread between the cash rate and the wholesale borrowing rate began to blow out, so that whereas in the US and the UK, the central bank was trying to cut the cash rate in order to ward off the early effects of this crisis, the rates which banks were paying didn't fall, and in the case of the UK actually went up, so that monetary policy became ineffective in lowering the cost of funds to ultimate borrowers. Here in Australia, where until March this year the central bank was still putting official cash rates up, the rates which borrowers paid went up by even more. And more recently, as the Reserve Bank, like banks overseas, has sought to bring the cash rate down, the rates which borrowers are paying, the rates which banks are paying for the funds that they lend to borrowers, haven't come down by as much. Although in Australia's case, the Reserve Bank has taken that into account, and in the last 2 months in particular has cut the cash rate by more than it otherwise would, in part to ensure that the rates which borrowers are actually paying are cut by the amounts that the Reserve Bank actually wants them to. And you can see from the way in which these spreads have begun to narrow in most cases over the last 4 weeks that the measures which were taken over that weekend of 11th and 12th of October have begun to work to alleviate the stresses in the financial system caused by the meltdown in the subprime mortgage market in the United States. They will take time, and in particular, banks around the world are going to continue to hoard cash and be reluctant to lend it until after the 31st of December, when most banks in the Northern Hemisphere roll off their balance sheets. But basically, the steps that need to be taken to stem the financial crisis narrowly defined have now been taken by governments around the world, and they just have to keep working at it. Even so, the economic consequences continue to linger, and one of those that affects nearly everybody is the dramatic tightening of credit standards that this crisis and the destruction of bank capital that has come with it has wrought. And by tighter credit standards, I don't mean simply wider spreads between benchmark rates and the rates which customers are actually paying, but also more demanding requirements for collateral, both in terms of amount and quality, more restrictive loan covenants than would have been the case before, certainly covenant light that was a key ingredient of the private equity boom is a thing of the past, and perhaps even more commonly, banks just simply saying no to requests for finance that they would have readily accommodated before 15 months ago. And that includes saying no to requests from borrowers with securitised debt that those borrowers are no longer able to roll over in the securities markets as they come up for redemption or maturity almost every day, depending on when and for what terms those securities were originally issued. Nor, of course, have any of the actions that central banks and governments taken in the last few weeks done anything to, nor could they have, forestalled the economic consequences of the financial turbulence that's occurred over the last 15 months. And what had, up until mid-September, been an unexceptional decline in equity markets around the world over the previous 11 months, has since then become an absolute rout that has seen share prices drop by an average of around 40%, or by a total at its worst point of $28 trillion US dollars. That is the equivalent of about 42% of the annual output of the world economy. And you simply can't take that much out of people's and institutions' wealth, especially given all the other things that have been going on, without that having some pretty dramatic economic consequences, of which we're really only beginning to see the early part thus far. In the US, it's been apparent for some time that a recession is in the offing, and indicators such as consumer confidence and unemployment, or indicators of discretionary spending such as motor vehicles or housing starts themselves, have for some months now been behaving in the way that they traditionally have done heading into previous recessions, such as the three which I've picked out in the grey bars on this chart. Somewhat to the surprise of many, the US hasn't yet experienced the consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth that the media often take as the defining hallmarks of a recession. In fact, that's a rule that's much more commonly used by the media than it is by economists. And you'll notice that during the US last recession in 2001, there weren't consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth either. There were three quarters of negative GDP growth, to be sure, but none of them was in succession or following another. This time around, I think we will get that. We've already seen growth contract by a quarter of a percentage point at an annual rate in the September quarter, and I think the contraction will probably be closer to 2 or 3 percentage points, even more than I've shown in that chart, in the December quarter and possibly in the March quarter as well. Up until the end of the September quarter, the GDP figures, the overall measure of American economic growth, was to some extent sheltered by the fact that America had been enjoying an export boom, thanks to the 40% decline in the value of the US dollar over the previous 4 years, as well as to the continued reasonably strong growth in most of America's major trading partners up to that point. But now, with most of America's major trading partners heading into recession, and with the US dollar rising since the end of July, the capacity of exports to make up for declining domestic spending is going to fade. Moreover, the US economy is going to be far less receptive to the traditional antidotes to recession than it has been in the past. First, because there's far less scope to use that traditional measure than there has been in the past. With a cash rate now at 1% in the US, the scope to cut it a lot more is obviously very limited. And with George Bush's legacy to President Obama, as he will be after 20th of January, being among other things, a $700 billion US deficit and climbing, it's going to be harder for the new administration to cut taxes or increase government spending in the way that previous administrations have done to bring recessions to an end. And even if there was more scope than there is, since those weapons of cutting taxes and cutting interest rates usually rely for their effectiveness on a willingness on the part of households to borrow and spend, given that this recession is being brought on by a newfound reluctance on the part of households to borrow and spend, the likelihood is that even if you could cut interest rates and taxes by much more than we actually can, that consumers wouldn't respond to that in the traditional way. So even if there are only, in inverted commas, three quarters of negative economic growth to come, what follows will be, at best, an extended period of very weak economic growth in which the unemployment rate could continue rising for quite some time yet to come. And the US certainly isn't going to get much help from any of its major trading partners. Europe actually went into recession before the United States. Not that that stopped the European Central Bank from hiking interest rates in July, 3 weeks after the first quarter in which the UK, in which the European economy had gone backwards. European banks are almost as much up to the gills in dodgy American mortgages as American banks themselves are. House prices are now falling across many European countries at rates not too dissimilar from what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic. And European governments have in many cases bigger budget deficits and more public debt than the American one does, equally limiting, therefore, their capacity to cut taxes and increase government spending. Japanese banks weren't much exposed to dodgy American mortgages, and they may end up being among the few winners out of this as they pick over the bones of parts of the American banking system. But Japan's economy has always been fragile since the collapse of its own bubbles 18 years ago, and most of the growth that Japan has had in the current decade has come from exports, which are now slowing as most of Japan's major trading partners experience either recession or sharp slowdowns in growth. Even China, which until a couple of months ago was thought largely to be immune from the financial crisis because its own banks had very little exposure to dodgy American mortgages, and because China, like most other emerging markets these days, was running big surpluses and thus wasn't dependent on continued inflows of investment funds from Western countries to support their growth, as most emerging markets had been prior to the crises of the 1990s. But what's now come back to bite China's economy on the tail, as it were, is the fact that its ability to build up those huge surpluses and the almost $2 trillion US dollar pile of foreign exchange reserves came from the willingness of people in Western countries to buy its exports. And now that China's major markets are in recession, China's export volumes are slowing significantly. Moreover, the downturn in China's major export markets has coincided with an internally generated property market slump, reflecting the fact that, as in Australia over much the same period, the Chinese central bank had been tightening interest rates with a view to putting an end to an internal speculative boom, which they have succeeded in doing. So not only is export growth slowing and that having some impact on manufacturing investment, but property construction investment has slumped as well. And it's the concern over that that has led the People's Bank of China to reverse its interest rate policy. And as we saw earlier this week, the Chinese government announced measures that, at least on the surface, sum to 4 trillion yuan, or about 580 billion US dollars, some 13% of annual GDP. Of course, the Chinese don't need to get themselves elected at regular intervals, but that doesn't mean they can't learn from the tricks that Western governments sometimes use to make these packages seem bigger than they are. In the first place, a lot of that 4 trillion is things that have been announced before and have been brought together in this package to make it sound bigger. And secondly, a lot of those measures are actually not going to be spent in the current financial year, but will be spent over the next 3 or 4 years. So the package isn't as big as it sounds, and obviously the financial markets have figured that out after their initially euphoric response to the announcement that came from Beijing at the beginning of the week. But the package does underscore the determination of the Chinese authorities to put a floor under their growth rate at somewhere around 8%, which they need to do if they're to continue creating enough jobs to absorb the roughly 10 million people a year who move from China's impoverished rural areas to their cities in search of work. And if they don't do that, given that people in China don't have the outlet which we have in Western countries to express our annoyance with failed economic policies, if that's what we perceive them, but instead are more likely to riot, promoting social instability. It's that, more than anything else, that lies behind the determination of the Chinese authorities to keep their economy afloat. And if the 4 trillion yuan, exaggerated as I say it was by the same sort of tricks that Western governments use, turns out not to be enough, then they will do some more, which they do undoubtedly have the capacity to do. And while a lot of what they do will be commodity intensive, it's important to set that in the context of the extent to which commodity demand has fallen over the last few months as Western economies fall into recession and China's own economic growth slows. The IMF told us last week, and it's hard to argue with them, that Western economies will in total see their economies shrink in 2009, something which has not happened since the late 1930s. Not even in the two most severe previous recessions of the mid-1970s and the early 1980s did the combined GDP of the big Western economies actually turn negative, but it probably will this year. It's just as well that developing economies represent a bigger share of the world economy than they did until even a decade ago, and that they are still going to record reasonable, though significantly slower, growth. Otherwise, the outlook for the world economy would be even lower than the 2.5% which now seems in prospect. That's actually better than the world saw in the mid-70s, early 80s and early 90s, when the developing world accounted for a much smaller proportion of the world than it does today. But even so, we have seen in recent weeks and will probably continue to see significant declines in the prices of a wide range of commodities, including energy and metals, some food products that rose on the back in part of speculative pressure, as well as the impact of subsidies for biofuels and bad harvests for other grains in the first half of this year. Even gold, which often does well in uncertain times such as these, has not been exempt from the declines in commodity prices. And of particular concern for Australia is the sharp fall in the spot prices of bulk commodities like coal and iron ore, which are, from Australia's perspective, usually traded on annual contracts. The spot prices of both coal and iron ore are now below the contract prices. Not surprisingly, major customers are proving reluctant to take some of the contracts which they'd signed up to at the prices which they'd pledged. And almost certainly, when contracts are renegotiated, effective from April next year, there'll be significant declines in the prices of both those commodities. And the so-called Baltic Dry Index, which is a proxy for bulk commodity shipping costs, has fallen by some 93% from its peak in July last year to its lowest level since about 2003, is a telling sign of where bulk commodity prices are likely to head, even if you allow that the decline in that index has been exaggerated by the difficulty getting access to letters of credit to finance exports and by a glut of now underutilised shipping having come onto the market at precisely the right time. It's the fall in the commodity prices which is one of the principal channels through which the global financial crisis and the economic downturn is affecting the Australian economy. Australia's prosperity has been underwritten to an extraordinary extent during the current decade by the steady rise in our so-called terms of trade, the ratio of export to import prices, which for most of the 20th century went in the opposite direction and was the biggest single reason, apart from our own economic mismanagement for most of the 20th century, why this country went from having the highest per capita income in the world at the time of federation to ranking only about 18th or 19th on that score by 1990. To an extent that most people don't realise, the huge recovery in the terms of trade during this decade covered up for a dramatic slide in our productivity growth rate during the current decade and made possible the large budget surpluses which the Howard government wanted you to believe was solely the result of their disciplined economic management. In fact, as Treasury has since said, although I used to say it at the time, the rate of growth of government spending during the last two terms of the Howard government was exceeded only during the Whitlam years, out of the last 40. And that's without taking account of the repeated large tax cuts that characterised the last four budgets of the Howard years. Now that's going into reverse. And whereas over the previous 5 years, rising commodity prices boosted our national income by an average of about a percentage point and a half per annum, over and above what was associated with growth in our output or our GDP. In 2009, falling commodity prices will subtract at least a percentage point from the income growth associated with the increase in our output, to the point where it's likely in the second half of 2009 that our real national income, as distinct from the volume of our output, may actually shrink by of the order of one percentage point per annum. That's not the same thing as a decline in real GDP, which the media focuses on, but it will be noticeable, especially to those who are in the front line of earning that export income. Australia's second point of exposure to the financial crisis stems from the fact that we run the world's sixth largest current account deficit. And unlike most of the countries which run bigger deficits than we do, we finance all of it through the commercial borrowings of the Australian banks. America finances two-thirds of its current account deficit by borrowing from foreign central banks, not because those foreign central banks necessarily want to lend to the US or regard US bonds as a good investment, but rather because they don't want their currencies to go up against the dollar, and in order to prevent that happening, they have to buy dollars. On the other hand, no central bank gives a toss about the exchange rate between their currency and the A dollar, so none of them buys Australian dollars except perhaps at the margin because they offer higher interest rates on Australian dollar paper. Nor do we finance any of our external deficit, as we used to do once, from net inflows of foreign equity capital, because Australian superannuation funds and companies now invest as much abroad as foreign pension funds and companies do in Australia. We don't finance any of our overseas deficit by government overseas borrowing, because at least up until now, our governments run surpluses and therefore don't need to borrow. So all of the borrowing that's required to finance our national habit of spending more than we earn is undertaken through the commercial banks. And that's why, even though the Australian commercial banks have no material exposure to dodgy American mortgages, unlike their European counterparts, and even though there has been almost no imprudent mortgage lending by Australian banks in the domestic market, as evidenced by the remarkably low delinquency and default rates on Australian mortgages, Australian banks have nonetheless found themselves subject to the same sort of pressures that banks in the Northern Hemisphere have done, including a significant increase in the cost of wholesale funds relative to the official cash rate, as well as increases in the cost of longer-term funds relative to government bond yields. Similarly, corporations who issue debt in their own name have seen the interest rates they have to pay for that relative to risk-free government bond yields more than double, while bank share prices in Australia have fallen relative to the average of other shares in much the same order of magnitude as they have overseas. And so, with banks having been faced with the same kind of pressures, albeit not to the point of having to write off large amounts of capital or incur losses, and in the face of rising interest rates in Australia, it's not surprising that we've seen a significant decline in the rate of growth of credit. The third channel through which Australia's economy gets caught up in all of this is through the impact on consumer and business confidence, not only of rising interest rates and rising fuel prices until recently, but falling share prices. Australian investors have lost almost $900 billion in total since November last year, and since most Australians are indirectly exposed to that through their super funds, they sort of know it. And they read about it in the press, which is, and I'm not criticising the press about this at all for a moment, been the vehicle for the portrayal of uniformly gloomy news about the world economy. And although business and consumer confidence do fluctuate, let me emphasise, I'm not criticising anyone in the media for saying that, that's how it is. Business and consumer confidence routinely move up and down for reasons that don't necessarily have anything to do with the economy and don't tell you anything about what's going to happen to the economy. The kind of movements in business and consumer confidence that we've seen occur this year do tell you something important, and they tell you it sooner than the official data that are always published with a lag actually do. For what it's worth, the official data do increasingly confirm that household spending is weakening significantly. In real terms, retail sales actually fell in the first two quarters of this year, although in nominal terms they are, of course, buoyed by rising prices. Motor vehicle sales are now declining. And the housing sector, although it never experienced the boom in construction activity that Europe and the United States did, is now declining quite significantly as well. There are some areas of the Australian economy on which we don't get data nearly as frequently, such as engineering, construction, spending and infrastructure that are doing okay. And at least up to the end of the September quarter, the long-awaited upturn in exports was actually happening, and that was providing some support to the economy as well. Australia does have a few things in its favour that, in my view, still mean that although we're in for a very tough time, it won't be quite as bad as some other countries are going to experience. One of those is that the corporate sector has entered this downturn in a much stronger position than it has entered previous downturns. Every one of Australia's three big previous recessions in the mid-70s, early 80s and early 90s has begun in part with the corporate sector facing high interest rates with highly geared balance sheets, seeing its profit margins under pressure and usually having experienced a surge in wage costs. And businesses have pretty uniformly found themselves obliged to make heavy cuts in their payrolls in order to survive that period. There are some businesses who are under the same pressure in Australia today, but the majority of them are not in a position where they need to slash their payrolls by predetermined across-the-board percentages in the way that they have done before. And I hope businesses do think carefully about the wisdom of doing that, because if we do see the same degree of across-the-board job shedding that we have done in previous recessions, then one of the other potential strengths of the Australian economy will not be as strong as it should be. And that is that the Australian housing market's fundamentals are stronger than those of the United States and Europe. Yes, it's true that Australian house prices are expensive relative to incomes and rents in the same way that they are in America and have been in America and many other countries. But unlike those other countries, that strength in house prices hasn't been the result of marginal buyers being induced into the housing market in the way that they have in America and Europe. Australia's central bank was one of the few in the world not to have made the mistake I mentioned at the beginning of leaving interest rates too low for too long at the beginning of this decade. On the contrary, the Reserve Bank was one of the first central banks in the world to start lifting interest rates in 2002, and they did that four times over the following 18 months, notwithstanding the considerable pressure that was put on the central bank by the government of the day. Had Ian Macfarlane not showed the wisdom and the courage, which he did in the face of that political pressure, there would have been far more Australians today with mortgages that they can't handle. Now that Australian mortgage rates are coming down, there's only one reason why people who could service mortgages when mortgage rates were almost 10% might not be able to as mortgage rates head down to or even below 7%, and that would be if they lose their jobs. Australia doesn't have an excess of housing in the way that the United States or Europe does, because we haven't had a building boom, and because up to this point, default and delinquency rates on Australian mortgages have been remarkably low. It would only be if we saw the unemployment rate head up to 8%, 9% or 10%, so that a large number of people who do have mortgages wouldn't be able to service them even at 7% mortgage rates, that we might see delinquency rates rise with attendant consequences not only for banks' provisioning requirements but also for house prices more generally. And that's something that I think Australia can avoid if managers of large companies in particular resist the knee-jerk temptation to sack lots of people just to prove how tough they are in tough times. The authorities here will do what they can to minimise those pressures on business. We've already seen the Reserve Bank cut the cash rate by as much in 2 months as they took more than 3 years to increase it, that is by 2 percentage points. And the Reserve Bank is no longer emphasising the primacy of above-target rates of inflation. Nor is it saying in its most recent statement, as it did after the 1 percentage point rate cut in October, that the most recent 75 basis point cut in rates should not be seen as a precedent for future moves. The likelihood now is that we will see the cash rate go below its previous low of 4.25% and may well be down to 3.5% by Easter. Given that the mortgage rate is now 75 basis points more above the official cash rate than it used to be, and that business borrowing rates haven't come down much at all despite the fall in the cash rate, a lower official cash rate will be required in order to get interest rates that people are actually paying down to levels that allow them to withstand the worst of the economic turmoil that is coming. Australia also enters this downturn with fiscal policy in a much stronger position than most other countries. It should have been even better than this if the Howard government had been more disciplined with the revenue windfalls it received from the commodities boom. But even so, the fact that we're entering this downturn with a surplus and no public sector debt means that the government can, A, afford to take a benign view of the damage which the downturn will do to its revenues without any decisions at all, and B, be willing, as it showed it was earlier this, during October, be willing to take additional decisions, even if that risks pushing the budget into deficit, in order to support the economy at its most vulnerable time. And it would be folly in the extreme for the government to resist pushing or allowing the budget to move into deficit just to avoid criticism of running budget deficits. One of the reasons why the New South Wales economy is in the mess that it is today is because its state government elevated the pursuit of zero debt and no deficits to the pursuit of some kind of policy objective in its own right. And New South Wales residents have been paying the price for that ever since. The reason why government should run surpluses in good times, the reason why I used to be critical of the previous government for not running bigger surpluses when they could, is so that you have the capacity to run deficits during bad times by cutting taxes and increasing government spending on infrastructure and the like at a time when the private sector is unwilling to do it. And I think the present government has indicated that they will do that, and if that means a deficit, well, good luck to them. That's what we need in those circumstances. That won't be enough to prevent 2009 looking pretty tough. At this stage, we don't think there will be consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, though that may be a matter more of good luck than good management. But as I mentioned before, that isn't actually the definition of recession that most economists use. An alternative definition, which actually makes more sense to the man or woman in the street, as well as to economists, is a period in which the unemployment rate rises by more than a percentage point in a year. And that's something we're almost certainly going to see during 2009, when we expect that the unemployment rate will get to about 5.75% or 6% by the end of next year, and probably peak at around 6.5% in the first half of 2010. By that definition, Australia is looking at a recession in 2009, albeit a much less severe one than many countries overseas will face. One other factor which will help to cushion this is the behaviour of the exchange rate. To some extent, the fall in the Australian dollar from its peak of 98 cents in July is a reflection of the fact that the US dollar has begun to rise against nearly every other currency except the Japanese yen. That may seem surprising given that the US is at the epicentre of this financial crisis, has the second lowest interest rates in the world apart from Japan, and has a $700 billion US budget deficit and rising. The dollar is rising against currencies other than the yen, partly for the same reason that if you want to borrow dollars, you have to pay some 2.5 to 3 percentage points above the official US interest rate. That is because people who have dollars don't want to lend them for fear that they won't get them back. And if you want to exchange them for a foreign currency, you have to surrender far more of that foreign currency than you used to in order to induce someone who doesn't want to part with dollars to do so. In other words, there's a degree of artificial scarcity about the US dollar at the moment, notwithstanding the attempts of the Federal Reserve through swap lines with other central banks to alleviate it, which is putting upward pressure on the dollar. as the arteries of the global financial system slowly unclog, the US dollar will give up some of this scarcity premium and it may well fall, in which case the Australian dollar and other currencies will probably rise again against the dollar, other things being equal. Another factor pushing the dollar up is that hedge funds tended to finance their leverage positions in the US dollar and in the Japanese yen because they had the lowest interest rates of all of the major currencies. And now the hedge funds are scrambling to get out of leverage positions to cover losses or are facing redemptions from their own clients. They're scrambling to acquire dollars and yen in order to repay the loans they took out in happier times. And that too is putting upward pressure on both the US dollar and the yen. Some of that may eventually unwind. But there are two other factors that are likely to keep the Australian dollar lower for longer than that. One, of course, is the collapse in commodity prices, which is not going to be over anytime soon. And the other is the substantial narrowing in the interest rate premium between Australia and the United States, simply because Australia has far more capacity to cut rates than America does and is using it. The Australian dollar has long been closely correlated with movements in commodity prices and in the interest rate spread between Australia and the United States, and as they fall, so too will the so has the Australian dollar. The bottom line out of all of this is that although the Australian dollar could bounce in the short term, it could go back over 70 US cents if the US dollar's current scarcity unwinds very quickly as the financial system itself gradually heals. The likelihood is during 2009 that we will see it trading in the low 60s or maybe even in the high 50s before eventually in 2010 some improvement in the world economy leads to increased demand for commodities and some modest recovery in the US dollar. Of course, for most Australians, other than for importers and retailers, a fall in the exchange rate is a good thing. It will cushion the impact of falling commodity prices and of weaker economic growth. And for those selling into the domestic market in competition with imports, it will give some relief from the competitive pressure that a strong exchange rate has caused over the last 2 or 3 years. That too, therefore, will be an advantage that Australia enjoys which most other countries don't. But to summarise, and without going through all of these dot points, which I'll leave up there for you to reflect upon, 2009 is shaping as a very tough year. And even as Western Australia's gas supply returns to normal going into 2009, as I assume it will, the full effects of the other major crisis that's been unfolding over the last 15 months are going to be felt pretty fully here as much as anywhere else. It'll be a tough year, and I wish you well in coping with it. I hope that's left a little bit of time for questions. I'm not in a rush to the airport, and if there are some, be happy to answer them.